Well, why don't we start now?
So hi, everyone. I'm Eric Davis again. I recognize some of your faces from previous sessions, and I'm grateful that I didn't scare you away or turn you off somehow, as I did with other people who are not here. So we get them, but don't worry about that. So today I wanted to talk about, let me back up and say that I always have a problem thinking or presenting on things without using a lot of case study examples. I like to root my analysis in concrete historical examples. And so I put together a bunch of things, and I originally titled it Tahrir, Madison, and Occupy. Is everyone familiar with Tahrir Square and Egypt and the Egyptian Revolution? Okay. Everyone know what happened in Madison last spring? Mm-hmm. Okay. A little bit better known. Everyone has some vague idea what Occupy is? Yes? Okay. We'll talk about each of them. I actually added three more examples to this because it helped me understand things. And so we can get to those or not as time permits. What I would like to do is start in Athens, since democracy is usually thought to start there. I think that's a little Eurocentric, but Athenian democracy set up by Pericles was adopted historically by the Europeans. So we think the Greeks are somehow, you know, the originators of European democracy, but the Greeks themselves were much more interested in talking to the Persians than they were to the Ostrogoths. So if anything, Greek democracy would be, you know, something that should be more a part of the world to the east of Greece than anything else. It's sort of a historical imagination, and a nice one. You know, I approve of democracy, so so it's a fine imagination, but there's some history there that we should sort of undercut ever so slightly. Okay, so we're going to start in Athens. This is not a picture of ancient Athens. This is a picture of a neighborhood in Athens called Exarchia, which is the place in Athens where almost every major sort of social, radical social street-based movement begins. That is because for a few decades it has been considered an autonomous zone. The police considered it a no-go area. In fact, they were forbidden from entering by their own obligations for a while. And it became a vibrant sort of anti-capitalist, radical, student-run neighborhood with lots of intergenerational stuff going on. So it was a functioning neighborhood, but very definitely different from much of the rest of Athens. The reason they've got torches and flares there to host their general assembly, what's going on here is a general assembly where people are making decisions consensually as a group, an enormous group. The reason they have to have the torches is because the city cut off all the power to the neighborhood. All right. So it looks a little bit more, you know, Jacobite, sort of, you know, it's like, we're going to go in and just slaughter all the people in Paris, you know, but no, actually, they're just trying to see. So let's start in ancient Athens. You know, we talk about it being the birthplace of democracy. One of the things that not everyone knows about Athenian democracy is that it was democracy by lottery, okay? So you didn't run for office. Instead, you got randomly selected to be in office. As a citizen, it was your duty. Consider for a moment what this says about the ways in which democracy was conceived. As C.L.R. James put it in the 50s, any cook can govern, right? Now, this wasn't entirely true. Although citizens of Athens were very horizontally and organized and considered each other equals, there was definitely an exclusive component to Athenian democracy. Women, for instance, were not considered members of the citus, right? They were not considered part of the political process. Children, obviously, were not. They rarely are. They also had a very large slave population. So Athenian democracy, hardly perfect, right? Organizationally, remains an inspiration. Today, new social revolutionary movements opposed to austerity. Everyone has a good idea of what austerity means. It means taking the debt of the state out of the backs of the citizens, right? That's austerity in a nutshell. Right? That's why you see sometimes the slogans, we won't pay for your crisis, or we won't pay for your austerity. Right? So bad decisions made by state leadership, or sometimes other states' leadership, being taken out of the hides of local citizens. They are opposed to austerity and the historical remnants of Greece's long-running fascist regime, the Metaxas regime. Greece remains a vibrant place for all sorts of political trends, including fascism. The Golden Dawn, the explicitly fascist program in Greece, won 7% in the recent election. It was a terrifying moment. They've been attacking immigrants throughout Greece quite violently, pulling them off buses, beating them up, murdering them. And Greece has an anti-immigrant milieu right now that rivals the American Southwest. So it's not great. And part of that is because of the financial crisis. Not everyone has a hardcore sort of economic focus on this or political focus, and so it's easy for people to think, it's the dirty immigrants from Albania, right, who are taking all of our good Greek jobs. And those people are attracted to rightist programs within the representational system and the Golden Dawn. The Golden Dawn screwed up pretty badly recently, though, and as a party, they're probably doomed. One of their candidates punched out a couple of female competitors on a daily talk show and then went into hiding for a few days before he was finally turned over. We'll see what happens. The police were guarding him from arrest, which is kind of the opposite of what they were supposed to do for a couple of weeks. The Exarchia neighborhood, which I already talked about, includes large, diverse populations. And the themes that I want to talk about in all of these cases today are these four themes. I had a fifth one until I added these last ones, because that doesn't make any sense to you at this point, so I'll just leave it there. But I wanted to put social media in here as well. Some of these movements were really organized, or at least originally, around social media. But as I added more case studies, it was clear to me that social media was not nearly as important to these organizations as it was originally expected, especially by the people who have shares in Facebook and Twitter. Okay, so the main themes, occupations of public space. Now, that shouldn't seem to be controversial, right? If it's public, the public should have access to it, right? Maybe there should be hours, right? We don't want to have people occupying museums all day and night, right? But, you know, if it's public space, the public should have access to it. However, throughout these occupations, people have, governments have created anti-gathering laws. Laws that prevent the gathering of, say, five or more people on a street corner, which is very reminiscent of old Jim Crow laws, right? The attempts to prevent anyone from looking dangerous in public with more than enough people to scare the gendarmes. All right. General assemblies and direct democracy is the second theme I would like to emphasize throughout these. Not all of these cases have all of these aspects, and I think that has something to do with the outcomes. Police and paramilitary violence. The paramilitary is there primarily for the Egyptian example. And general strikes. General strikes. Everyone knows what a general strike is? No, does anyone not know? Okay, great. Thank you for being brave enough to say that. A general strike is different from a regular strike in that everyone in the area is supposed to go out on strike. It is a much faster way to win a strike than if one group goes out. We actually had an attempt at a somewhat general strike back in 2006 in the United States on May Day, when we called for a day without an immigrant, right? And so people who were immigrants were supposed to not go to work that day and just demonstrate exactly how dependent American business is on various types of immigrants, whether documented or undocumented. Let's start in Tahrir Square, a place in the middle of Cairo which had, at various points, hundreds of thousands of people. It was an amazing place. Tahrir Square began as a response to various pressures within Egypt. There are certainly local pressures, right? They'd never had an election that really mattered, right? They'd had a dictator, Hosni Mubarak, for many, many years. Vast police corruption, vast economic corruption, incredible inequality. Egypt is also heavily riven by religious conflict. And one of the things that connects those two religious conflicts together is Egyptian nationalism, which is why you will see the Egyptian flag, sometimes extremely big Egyptian flags, being paraded through the streets. That aspect does concern me, as it always concerns me when I see nationalist protest movements. But we can talk about that in a moment. So they had general assemblies. They had the general assemblies. They were making decisions in huge mass groups, which is a difficult process to do. It's very difficult. But it is also, sociologists who have studied consensus process have identified a couple of things that happen. Groups that operate by consensus either have extremely short lifespans or tend to be in it for the long haul. Groups that operate by consensus tend not to come to middle-of-the-road compromise decisions, which you would imagine, right? If everyone's working on a consensus model, what tends to happen is that the discussion goes on for about 5 weeks, whereas, you know, you and I might have a 5-minute discussion. So it can be very frustrating. And then they tend to come out with incredibly conservative or incredibly radical decisions for the entire group. So it's a very fascinating way of making decisions that has sociologically predictable results. What was wonderful in Tahrir Square to see was the anti-sectarianism of the models. Christians, so Coptic Christians in Egypt, and Muslims held simultaneous multi-faith services in Tahrir Square. On days when Christians were praying, Muslims would create physical boundaries with their bodies around the prayers to prevent the military and the police from coming in and breaking heads. Simultaneously, the reverse happened when the Christians created a boundary around the Muslims for their Friday prayers. It was really, I mean, chilling. I've actually got goosebumps at the moment. It was aimed at toppling the government. The major demand was the resignation and leaving of the country of Hosni Mubarak. They did engage in many general strikes. There were about three, if I recall. And these general strikes were very effective. They put huge pressure on the government. Now, this was true in places like Tunisia and in places like Egypt, primarily because neither of those countries have large oil reserves. So what some of the other countries that have been engaged in the Arab Spring revolts have done is that they have transferred some of the wealth from their national oil production to citizens. So they've made concessions of various sorts. And you know, you can see this as buying off to a certain extent. They quelled protest by giving, you know, concessions to the public. Egypt didn't have that option, neither did Tunisia. And of course it began with the Burning Man, Mohamed Bouazizi, in Tunisia, who absolutely dispirited by, he was a greengrocer on the street, and absolutely dispirited by constant police harassment and intimidation. He had been beaten up just recently by police. He set himself aflame, and that sparked what we now call the Arab Spring, and was copycatted throughout much of the realm. In fact, I think that the recent spate of Tibetan self-immolations, which many of my colleagues are trying to understand in traditional Buddhist terms, which it does have a Buddhist history, in China specifically, I think it actually has more to do with imitations of Wuzizi. I think that that's what's going on there, but that's kind of sorry. All right. The first stage of the protests ended with the transfer of temporary power to the military, the Supreme Council of Armed Forces, and promise of elections in 6 months, which resulted in Mohamed Morsi's election. There have been a lot of back and forths here. In my opinion, and the opinion of a lot of my friends, the acceptance of the legitimacy of the armed forces was a disastrous decision. And many, many Egyptians who were very central in the protest movement from the beginning came to agree with us after the fact, and they are still struggling through. There have been some positive moments, though, since then. The elections were very, very hard fought and not perhaps entirely as good as they should have been. But they did elect Mohamed Morsi from the Muslim Brotherhood, which was clearly the democratic will of the people, whether or not people in America like that idea or not.
Was there really a choice about accepting the military's role at that point, do you think?
Well, it's a great question. So one of the things that had happened was that the armed forces had originally sided with the people in Tahrir. And so the people were chanting things like, the people in the army are one fist, right? And I think some of us who look at revolutionary movements historically were horrified at that moment. But you can understand why they were doing it, right? And people typically side with the military against the police when there's a distinction between those two for very obvious reasons. The military is usually a much broader realm of social mobility and employment. It's also usually directed at people outside of the country rather than at disciplining their own citizens. So when people get into trouble with one of those two groups, it's usually the police, right? Not the military. So I didn't like that moment, but there you go. Let's move on to Madison and do some comparison. In Madison, woohoo! It was a response to the anti-labor legislation, anti-public sector union labor legislation by newly elected Governor Scott Walker, who was elected with 51% of the vote. And that will be an important number to remember in a moment. There were no general assemblies in Madison. Yeah, none. It was almost entirely devolved to sort of a general sort of outpouring of occupation of public space. But all strategy was held in small circles, largely in the Democratic Party, and in small union groups and the union councils. So there was no General Assembly, there was no consensus decision making in Madison. Okay? There was also no police violence. In a way that somewhat mirrors the relationship of the military and the people in Tahrir, the Madison PD and the Madison Fire Departments came out strongly in favor of the Madison occupation, which I'm not going to call occupy because it wasn't, but it was called the occupation.
And they were accepted from the public, the anti-labor association came out anyway.
Yes.
And police departments from all over the state helped guard the Capitol, quote unquote, guard the Capitol, but
It was amazing. Yeah, it was really. I mean, in a situation where people, as I said before, if they get into trouble with either the military or the police, it's the police, right? And yet nobody was afraid of the police in this protest situation. It was really a fascinating moment. It was really fascinating. Yes, sir. It was, but as Connie pointed out, you know, they were actually explicitly accepted from this.
Yeah.
And so this was an actual act of real genuine solidarity on the part of police and fire departments. They didn't have to go out. They're you know, now, I mean, they may have been seeing the writing on the wall, you know, the minute the other folks get kicked out, you know, those lazy teachers who are preventing education from actually making any progress. And lazy prison guards and everyone else, you know, all those lazy workers. Once we get rid of their protections, you know, we're going to move to a subscription service for fire departments, much like they have in some places on the mid-Atlantic coast now, where they'll just let houses burn if they haven't paid a subscription fee. So, you know, maybe they saw the writing on the wall, but at any rate, it resembled a real genuine act of solidarity. So, no general assemblies, no police violence, a very uncertain identity. A lot of it was, whereas Tahrir was largely nationalist, Madison was largely statist, right? It was like, we are Wisconsin, right? And so it was a Wisconsin identity. And it was, you know, some of it was labor, and that was interesting. I saw some great sort of warmth towards labor, which is very uncommon in the United States. Usually you bring up unions or anything, and you get an earful of vituperation. But I was very interested in Madison to see how friendly people were, even to relatively radical unions like mine. It was intended to preserve labor rights in Wisconsin. It included an aborted call for a general strike, and I'll talk about that in a moment. And it ended with a decision led by the DFL, not the DFL, they don't have the DFL in Wisconsin. Yeah, sorry about that. To campaign for the recall of Governor Walker, which failed. Anybody know the percentage by which he won his recall? 52%. He got, yeah. So he actually got 1% more of the vote in his recall election than he did in his original election. Absolutely, which indicates the role of money in campaigns. Sorry, it's not applicable to this, but in Minnesota, it's the Democratic Farmer Labor Party, which was a real, it was what is sometimes called a Jacobin strategy, where they connect rural people with urban workers. And it was one of the reasons, I think, why Minnesota remained as progressive as long as it did. These are some pictures from here. We've got the Union Thug up here. Right. We've got the occupation of the Capitol Rotunda. We've got my dear friend Neil Whitehead, an anthropology professor at University of Wisconsin-Madison, who just passed, and I miss him dearly. And we have some of my friends from Minneapolis, members of my union, holding the outside agitators go home sign. Now, my union, the IWW, which is mentioned down here, came to the South Central Federation of Labor in Wisconsin and promoted the idea of a general strike. They said, we're not going to win this with a recall. I should just point out that my union, which proposed this, is opposed to any electoral representation at all and has laws in its bylaws that would prevent us from endorsing or criticizing any political party. So we're open to all workers, regardless of party affiliation. We accept Republicans, Democrats, et cetera, people of no party. But we cannot, as a union, take stances on electoral politics. We don't believe that that's the way we'll win. So we think that the Democrat-Republican divide, for instance, unnecessarily divides workers. Okay. So we attempted to push for a general strike. The South Central Federation of Labor loved it, and they made a general call for it. This was a huge moment. And we attempted to mobilize for a general strike, but because there was no common venue for discussion of strategy and decision making, the general strike fizzled. And the pre-existing institutional forces, the Democratic Party, moved forward with their recall election, which took a year, almost a year and a half, and failed miserably. Let's move on to Occupy. We can see some more police violence here. This is the infamous John Pike, who has now been fired, although I'm not sure that's sufficient. But you can see, I mean, this is California. And he, you know, these people were just sitting there on there, and he decided to just douse them with pepper spray. These images of police violence are incredibly useful for public protest. I mean, ever since the civil rights movements of the 60s, you know, the images of unresisting protesters being terribly brutalized has been a call to arms for a relatively apathetic general populace. People who don't really care about the issues or who don't know about them see stuff like this and they say, you know what, that I know that's not right, right? No matter what else is going on, I know that's not okay. And so this has been a huge sort of boon to the movement at the same time that has resulted in horrible injuries. Many of you know of the case of veteran Scott Walker, who in the early days of the Occupy Oakland protest was shot at about 20 feet range by a police, probably a concussion grenade. It wasn't intended to hit a person, it's intended to be shot at the ground and then release sound and noise. And instead they hit him right in the head. He lost, he had brain damage, he remains brain damaged. He made a pretty miraculous recovery and has regained most of his speech control, although his voice will never be the same as it was. That was also an important movement, a moment, since veterans are largely respected in the country, although they aren't taken care of very well. Occupy began as a call from a culture-jamming magazine in Canada called Adbusters. And they sent out a call that said, we need our own Tahrir Square. So clearly and definitively inspired by Tahrir Square. By the way, people in Tahrir Square were sending free slices of pizza to the folks in Madison. So they were calling up a local pizza place and saying, send pizzas. And so they were saying, you know, let's go, you know, you guys are with us. It was very interesting. So Occupy also took some inspiration from Tahrir. Adbusters called for a general conference in New York. I think it was the New Yorkers Against Budget Cuts. And everyone showed up, and there were basically a predetermined set of demands, and they were going to say, let's march on the local offices and say, make these legislative changes. And that was incredibly disappointing to many people. A gentleman I talked about for most of the hour yesterday, David Graeber, was there, and immediately organized, he's also a member of my union, he immediately organized a general consensus, a general assembly based on consensus. And that's where we get those silly hand signals you might have seen, right? I wanted to say, you know, point of process, I've got something to say, I approve, I disapprove, I'm going to block this one, I'm so angry at this one, I'm going to block it, right? And these are ways to help communication happen without slowing down so that everybody has to say something about how they feel, right? You can kind of take a look at the room. So how many people are human beings in here? Do this if you're a human being. I don't have to ask if you're a human being, I can just see that, you know, in case it wasn't clear to begin with. So they created this general assembly by consensus model, which rapidly spread to other cities. And although there's a lot of criticism of consensus, it's so slow and so painful. It has nevertheless been quite a success, at least in terms of its spread. The encampments are largely gone. I don't know what to make of this. I really don't. Sometimes I like to blame it on the weather. Spain, which has had, you know, multi-year encampments at places, so they wax and wane, you know, is a bit warmer through the winter. Minnesota, you know, not so much. It's hard to do that. The only people who stayed into the really deep parts of the winter were homeless people who were being protected by activists. I mean, homeless people, as you undoubtedly know, are subject to an enormous amount of violence on the streets. It's very hard to find a safe place to sleep, let alone to remain warm and fed. And so the hardcore, the people who stayed into late December, right, were anarchists and crust punks and folks who, you know, don't get a whole lot of public support, but were feeding people for free, guarding them at night, and making sure that things were good. They're all basically gone at this point. Still active Occupy groups, such as Occupy Homes, have moved on to more specific programs. There's no longer an attempt to demand everything, right? But instead to accomplish specific things through direct action tactics. Occupy Oakland is still the most vibrant ongoing Occupy place in the nation. It had an early commitment to addressing issues of racial as well as economic justice, which differentiates it from many of the Occupy movements. Many of the Occupy movements were early on harshly criticized, and largely correctly so, for being an overwhelmingly white male setup. You know, you go into Zuccotti Park in the early days and it was, wow, this doesn't look like New York, right? And it was a bunch of white guys, a bunch of white dudes. And that did change over time, although I don't think Occupy has ever been as representative as the American populace. That is different in Oakland, whether Oakland, because of Oakland's natural sort of local diversity, or because of the connection that was made early on to the police murder of Oscar Grant, which they renamed the plaza Oscar Grant Plaza in his honor. So there was an early commitment to racial justice as well as economic justice. They had general assemblies, and they, by all accounts, I haven't been to Oakland in this period, but by all accounts, they've been pretty well run. There's been a lot of police violence in Oakland. There always is in Oakland. This isn't particularly new, but liberal Jean Kwan, who likes to tote her sort of her early radicalism movements. You know, I was involved in the civil rights movement back in the 60s, was one of the first people to call for and demand police violence against the occupiers. So, you know, it's one of those, you know, first time is tragedy, second time is farce sort of things. So police violence was a very important thing in creating a anger and resilience of the movement against dissolution. Also, Oakland, warmer than Minnesota. Maybe that has something to do with it. They did call for a general strike, and they pulled it off. This is the general strike poster that was created by Eric Drucker, for the IWW. He also created this one, and at the bottom of that poster it says, Liberate Oakland, November 2nd. Oakland has ports. Ports are wonderful places to do strike actions, because the minute you can shut down the movement of goods and goods that are necessary for other types of industry, you can really make demands. That's why the ILWU and the Teamsters have always been some of the most powerful unions around, even if they haven't always directed their energies towards the most progressive causes. Up on the upper right hand, you can see people standing on shipping containers in the port itself. They shut it down for the whole day. It was, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, as a penalty for the police violence and the way in which they were treating Occupy. So that's direct action, as opposed to asking Gene Kwan to, can you please back off? Can you talk? Can you tell the police to stop, et cetera? This is taking matters into your own hands and trying to make change directly. In Occupy Homes, in Minnesota, it's been focused on anti-foreclosure and eviction. They've had a lot of public information campaigns, including public shamings of upper-level bank officers. They've traveled around the country and attempted to get meetings with different bank officers who have decision-making capacity. And they've brought cameras, they've asked news media to come. And they have, you know, made very plaintive, clear demands. And when you are faced with that on camera, and you have to say, no, screw you, you're poor and you're probably a bad person, it's a real moment of public shaming and information, right? You can really see where people's loyalties lie. It's been the most successful tactic in the Twin Cities that I've seen. We've had a lot of arrests, a lot of civil disobedience. I think 6 or 7 homes have been saved at this point. And by saved, yeah.
Could you say, I've been gone for 4 years in Central Europe. Can you tell me what it means, occupying homes?
Sure. So it means various things in various circumstances. Sometimes they've actually reoccupied homes that were self-evicted because they were expecting the sheriffs to come. Other times it means remaining in the home before the sheriffs come.
Because they hadn't been able to pay the...
Yeah. That's right. So the oftentimes they had ARMs, right? Adjustable rate mortgages, which just went through. Right. A lot of these folks are, you know, about to be evicted or have recently been evicted. And folks have massed into the homes. And they have created protective barriers, and they have forced arrests. If you see, my friend Tick here he's locked down. So they've got an enormous 55-gallon barrel drum filled with concrete and rubble. And there's a piece of concrete in there with a hook. and he has handcuffs to which he has the key in his pocket. He reaches through this tube, which is connected to that barrel, and hooks the other end of the handcuff into the hook in there, right? And so what happens, and this has been a consistent tactic, it's intended to slow the police down, right? What the police do is they take jackhammers, and they're taking jackhammers about an inch from people's hands, right? And that's what they're going to do. I mentioned this yesterday, but shortly after this eviction took place, the city of Minneapolis was forced to release a statement, which I consider one of the most amazing and truthful statements the city of Minneapolis has ever released. The Minneapolis Police Department is not in the business of ordering public safety. We are in the business of protecting private property.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So again, these struggles create information for the public, right? They reveal hidden agendas and things which normally are covered over in normal political speak, right? Bones of contention for me personally, these are all private homes. There are more homeless people on the streets of Minneapolis and St. Paul than there are people facing eviction and foreclosure. There are more empty homes in the United States than there are homeless individuals. I think we need to get bigger. But I'm thrilled that direct action of this sort in protection of private property, which is fine, is becoming an acceptable and lauded tactic. I think we need to start bringing it into our workplaces. Montreal. Montreal, has anyone heard of the student movement in Montreal? Okay, one of the cheapest places to get a higher education in North America. High quality education, very low tuition, very low fees. There was a law that said, well, the economy's hurting, we're gonna make the students pay a little bit more for it, right? Significantly more, it's about a 300% increase if I remember correctly, right? But it was still far less than anyone south of the border pays for education. Right? And so many Americans are like, well, what are you complaining about? And they're like, what aren't you complaining about? But Montreal began as a student-based strike, right? Anti-tuition and fees hikes. They had general assemblies. Instead of consensus in these assemblies, they worked on a voting model, right? So individual direct voting, direct democracy as opposed to consensus, right? It has a very complicated relationship to nationalism as a result of being located in Quebec. The Franco-Canadians, the Québécois, have always had a sub-nationalist sort of approach to the rest of Canada, and so they're less likely to call themselves Canadians, but they also realize that provincializing themselves solely within the realm of Québécois is going to result in failure. And so increasingly much of the dialogue has taken place in English, especially intended for the rest of the world, even though they all speak French primarily. It gathered enormous power after the repressive Loi 78, which is an anti-protest, anti-gathering law. Basically, you know, you can't be on the streets with more than a couple people, right? Or we will arrest you, it's illegal. Everybody came out after that. It was no longer a student movement. Okay? And it has faced extreme police repression and violence. So general assemblies with voting, I think, was the key to the radicalization and resilience of the movement in Montreal. And a substantial amount of police violence has increased public anger and participation in the protest. Spain is so fascinating. So Spain has had anti-austerity protests for well over a year now. It began with the May 15 movement, way over a year now back. And these were anti-austerity, pro-labor, pro-employment things. So we've got basically 25% unemployment in Spain right now, and that is heavily tilted towards the younger populations, as it always is. So young people are much more unemployed than older people. The average for all workers is 25% unemployment. So that's really hard. And people are seeing the loss of any competent or winnable future for themselves, a future that they can live in, right? And so people have taken to the streets. They don't have any jobs to go to, so why not? There have also been another group called the Indignados, who tend to be older folks. They tend to be people who are simply indignant. It's a solidarity movement. They don't feel themselves, they don't present themselves as suffering the exact consequences of the things they're protesting, but they are indignant at the way in which other people in Spain are being treated.
They're housing younger people. They're involved.
Yeah.
They're all living at home still.
Right, right. Well,
being in the house.
Much like I expect my children to do.
Bathroom.
Right, exactly. So this was a response to the government accession to euro demands of austerity. The government had very little choice in the matter. The eurozone has basically taken over much of economic policy in Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain. What we call the PIGS. If you read in the newspapers, you'll see that acronym sometimes. They've been extremely resilient, long running. There have been a few general strikes. As with France, the most effective ones in the cities tend to be transportation strikes. You can shut down a city that way. Recently, a new militancy has arisen when Asturian miners were laid off as an entire region. Miners occupied the area and have resisted military and police violence with their own defensive violence. There's enormous support for the miners from the Spanish public. This is a picture of a nighttime protest in Madrid. The Asturian miners came. They're wearing their mining caps. Now, I want to talk briefly about where Asturias is. Asturias is originally, in European history, famous for being the place where the Moorish invasion was repelled. Now, partly that's because you go up to northern Spain, and you go la-da-da-da-da, and then all of a sudden Asturias goes like this. There's a steep embankment. It's almost impossible to take with a land crew, right? And so they're just sitting up there lobbing things down at whoever's coming at them, right? Well, that was interesting, and probably the basis for a great deal of Spanish nationalism and anti-Islam and Islamophobia. But in 1934, when Franco's fascist regime brought Moorish troops from Morocco, Moorish troops at the time, to defeat the communist and anarchist uprising in defense of Republican Spain, the fascists were trying to take over the government by force, Asturias was one of the longest-running places of resistance. It was the only place where the Spanish government had no chance of controlling until Franco used German aircraft to bombard the region, much as they did with the famous Basque region, which we know from Pablo Picasso's Guernica, if you've ever seen that incredibly moving painting. Yeah. So Asturias. The entire region is based on mining, period. That's pretty much all that happens in Asturias. And it's entirely run on the fact of government subsidies. So the miners were mining ore for the government, right? The government employees, basically, yes. You know, I think it's coal, but I honestly don't know. I should know, but I don't. The government said, well, we just can't afford it anymore, so the entire region is laid off. And so it's not just, you know, a sector. Everybody loses their job. The Asturian miners said, no, we're going to keep mining, thank you very much, and we're going to control our own work, right? It's going to be us. We're going to do this. Well, the government said, no, you're not. We're going to close the mines by force, and they sent police and paramilitaries into the region, who, of course, met the exact same strategic challenges that other groups have met, right? One of these challenges is the creation of homemade missiles. These are just metal tubes, and they're basically putting fireworks in there. These aren't terribly deadly. No police have been injured. The only injury that we know of is a civilian who was sent basically as a provocation by the government on a train which was publicly supposed to be stopped. The miners had put logs on the rails as an attempt to barricade, and they told people, we don't want any trains in here. So, of course, the first thing the government does is send a passenger train in there. The train derailed, and he broke his leg. So that's, although this looks very, very dangerous, right? And I'm, you know, I would be guessing that these people wouldn't be too sad if they hurt some folks. They're pretty pissed off. They're seeing their lives and livelihood and their ability to feed themselves disappear. At the same time, nobody has really been hurt in this. There's a barricade also to keep police from coming in. Most recently in the United States, Anaheim. Another place where racial justice takes the center. Anaheim began as a response to the extrajudicial police execution of a Latino man named Manuel Garcia. I say it was an execution because he was on his stomach in handcuffs behind his back when they shot him in the back of the head. Immediately after that, community people gathered and were starting to protest. They also waited 3 minutes while he was dying and twitching before calling an ambulance as people were yelling at him. I mean, this is all on video now, of course, thanks to cell phone cameras. And people gathered immediately thereafter, and the police responded with really overwhelming violence to those protesters, using tear gas, hoses, batons, etc. They released dogs, a canine unit, on a woman with a baby. Grabbed the baby as well. Okay. It's a dominantly Latino population. There is no Latino representation on city government. The city has traditionally refused sectoral representation. So instead, they have a situation where the whole city votes on the whole city council, right? And so it's easy to rig it so that there are no Latinos on the council. So it has a long history of intense police violence exercised largely against this local population. It's the happiest place on earth as long as you're not Latino and live there. Right? So again, police violence was crucial in the escalation of public protest here. The police are currently under siege by the public. Now, I wrote that before I came up here. I don't know what the current situation is. This is a post-execution protest in Anaheim. And down here, you can see the barricades that the police erected around the police department. Anytime the police are terrified of the local population, you know something interesting is happening. Now, those are the case studies I wanted to bring to you. And again, if I can return to the themes. In each of these, we've seen occupations of public space. In some of these, we've seen general assemblies of different sorts. Some are consensus-based assemblies, decision-making. Some of them are direct democracy voting. But we have seen public general assemblies in most of these, not in Madison, and not yet in Anaheim that I'm aware of. We have seen police and paramilitary violence in all of these except for Madison. And we have seen general strikes in most of these, except Madison and Anaheim, at least yet. What's interesting to me is the way in which these various characteristics of these occupation movements, which all began as sort of responses to various things and attempts to use public space to force and frame a set of demands, is how these various characteristics can be used to understand the relative failure or success, or at least the direction in which these various movements have gone. And so with that, I'd like to end my sort of presentation and ask for any questions or discussion. Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
What were the variables different in Madison? Like, why were the police, I'm imagining there was some kind of relationship across some lines at Madison that doesn't exist in these other places, but that's just my guess.
They're not from Madison. They're not from Madison.
What was it that made that?
Yeah, I was there through March, but that was it.
There's a woman.
I'm just wondering if anything can be learned from that, or whether maybe we don't want to. Maybe we want to have the violence to help propel the movement. I'm just curious.
I have my own outside agitator view, but I'd rather ask the folks from Madison what you think about that question.
There was great pressure on the Chief Tubbs, who was in charge of the police, to arrest and to bear down on the occupiers. Yeah. But that was just not his. Just refuse. There was great pressure on him to arrest everybody in the Capitol.
I think there was
just simply refused to do it. Was that from above him? Or
yeah, but he was sympathetic.
He was sympathetic of the occupiers, and he simply had a very soft way of reasoning with them. He would walk around and say, "I'm going to pick this up," and people respected him. They did what he asked.
Very gentle.
He's very, very gentle, highly respected man.
Would you explain that as a result of his personal, identity and who he was as a person, or were there other institutional pressures coming to bear on him beyond that opposed arrest?
Well, there was great pressure on him
to arrest. But were there pressures countervailing that he was also experiencing that may have influenced him? Or was this really a moment of personal heroism?
Him as a person, that was just not his character. And we really felt that he was going to be fired.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He was not fired.
I'm amazed.
He was not, but yeah, then when it was all over with, I mean, he was moved out of that position.
Yeah.
So it's like he lost his job.
They say he retired.
I mean, it was a political.
Yeah. You can't keep your job as an executioner if you refuse to fire the gun.
The rules that came to bear, such that the Capitol got locked down, it took a long time to lock the Capitol against the people. And it only happened gradually. But then the checkpoints, the Capitol's traditionally open to everybody most of the day, every day, without question. To me, one of the most remarkable things was after a period of increased security with vast numbers of police at the door, the two doors that were open, even the children that were coming for a field trip to the Capitol, this is after the major protests and the farmers had already finished, it was the summer, four-year-old kids were being wandered through security checkpoints because the kind of angry liberalism of the other side, a sort of fundamentalist black and white, it's just been going on for quite a while. So
one of the things that you said, and the way that your recall went in Wisconsin, you said that allowed the progressive movement in Minnesota to go as long as it did, indicates that there's been a shift both in Wisconsin and Minnesota.
Why is that?
Is a response, I'm guessing it's probably a response to what happened in 2008.
I think it goes back farther.
Mm-hmm.
I think the dissolution in Minnesota of the Democratic Farmer Labor Party's sort of power has been a long-running story, the origins of which I'm not really, I don't feel like I have a firm grasp on those.
Is that just in Russia?
You know, Minnesota is such a weird place. We always had a very relatively progressive, I mean, conservative, but progressive at the same time, in different ways,
well,
legislature and weird governors. We always had weird governors. Anybody remember Rudy Perpich? You know, or Jesse Ventura, right? I mean, it all kind of started unraveling around that period, but I don't know what the causes are. I think that, you know, it may be larger than any given state or political party's, you know, attempts. I mean, I think the United States as general has taken a pretty hard right turn over the last 30 years. To the extent that, as people are fond of pointing out, Barack Obama is far more conservative than Ronald Reagan, and Ronald Reagan could never be elected by the Republicans these days.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we've taken a pretty hard right turn, and I think the causes of that are probably so complex that my small brain can't handle them.
Sure, it might take distance of decades to be able to.
I think so. I think this is a story that, should we survive the next few decades and manage climate change, we'll be writing in a few decades from now.
It seems like so much of this has been fueled by the fall of communism across the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering what you think about this focus on austerity, how that is going to affect these movements. It seems like it's just fueled by fire.
It's astonishing, you know. Inside of 1 year, we had Fidel Castro come up and say, communism doesn't work. And then a few months after that, Alan Greenspan got in front of the United States legislature and said, the religion to which I have dedicated my life, and I use the word religion very, very intentionally here, doesn't work. There's a flaw in the system, he said. Capitalism is not a functioning model of economy. So the high priest of capitalism and the last remnant of sort of state-based communism both claimed that, you know, the ideologies they've been working with and defending their entire lives were defunct. So, you know, capitalism has been a tenet of American faith for quite a while now. And it seems like for the first time in many, many years, at least economic issues are of concern to Americans. And I think many Americans are struggling with how those concerns should be addressed in different ways. Some people want to rejigger the tax rate. Some people want to, you know, institute a Scandinavian-style sort of socialism, increase social welfare. Other people think the only way to do it is by, you know, eliminating all state-based aid to the needy and making them take responsibility for their own lives because they're a bunch of lazy fools. It's a lot of different approaches, but it seems like for the first time in many, many years, the general populace is becoming more involved in discussions about economics and connecting those discussions to issues of justice and fairness, whatever those ideas of justice and fairness are for them.
And the gap is bigger than it's been in 100 years.
It's the gap is enormous, and certainly that there's a moment of what we call immiseration going on, right?
Yeah.
People get so sunk in misery that they're just like, I can't take it anymore. Now,
the ones who are not in misery see how imminent misery is, how close, how easy, how ordinary it would be to fall. It's just the notion of a paycheck away is so
fragile.
Having introduced the word immiseration, though, I do need to make a caution, which is that many of us sometimes think that things won't change until things just get bad enough. And I want to point out that's been rejected by almost every sociologist in the world. And the good counterexample to that is North Korea, right? If all you need is for things to get bad enough for people to rise up and organize for social change, North Korea should give you pause, right, to that theory. Diane?
I want to ask you about Egypt.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
And she was there when the occupied movement started there.
Yeah.
And is, of course, extremely concerned about the early church.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm very moved by the story you say about the protection. So now that the Brotherhood has power and the violence is starting again, how does this work?
I try and avoid, this all probably sounds like a horrible set of very loud personal opinions. I actually try and avoid investing this with personal opinion. If you want my real personal opinion, they should never have left Tahrir Square. They should never have given anything over to the SCAF. And being in presence with each other would have created more connections and more cooperation. Instead, we had the burning in Alexandria of the church, the Coptic church in Alexandria. The Muslim Brotherhood is not nearly as horrible and awful as the American media makes it out to be, but the Muslim Brotherhood and Egyptian people in general tend to be quite awful to Coptic Christians, and anti-Semitism is also a huge thing. I'm one of those who believes that you can be simultaneously pro-Jewish and anti the state of Israel, but in Egypt, it is pretty much the same thing, by and large. Anti-Semitism is a huge problem there. Coptic Christianity is in danger in many ways in Egypt. It may not surprise you to know that for the last few centuries, the ancient graveyard of Karafa has become the home of the largest Coptic community in Cairo. And it's a slum community built on top of graves. It's a very serious issue. I got scared first when I saw the 2-mile-long Egyptian flag trotted out. That made me nervous, because nationalism always freaks me out. I don't know what's going to happen. I know that the patriarch of Coptic Christianity, who was alive at the time, he passed just 2 months ago, I believe. He took public and very vocal stances against Tahrir. And so I know that many people, with their inability to distinguish between institutions and people, blamed the Coptic Church for some of the reaction. And if I knew the answer, I would be over there right now. But I don't. Yeah. Does that address some of your?
Yeah, part of it, my reaction to it is, welcome to the human sin. We have the movements that have this righteousness on the side, their side, and as soon as power is transferred, power can corrupt, and so you just see it in operation, and then I have less, not less sympathy, but less
more fear.
Hope in the movements which...
The dictum that power corrupts seems to be a truth.
Yeah.
And it's the reason why, while I'm an anti-capitalist, I'm opposed to the state. Because those who manage to take over political power and authority and tell people how they can and cannot do and that they know what's right, tend to become jerks, right? Mm-hmm. Joe Stalin was not my friend, and you've been waiting a long time.
Well, it was interesting the police response in Seattle, because the Seattle police have been supposedly learning something about responding from the WTO. So their response was to be more low-key in the very beginning, and we have a mayor who's very liberal, and you know, his president's very close.
That was an amazing picture, wasn't she? And
yeah.
She, if I remember, she's an immigrant from a country, I can't remember, she was suffering extreme violence as a youth as well, through police repression. She was, you know, in her 80s, and watching her walk away with, you know, tears streaming down her face, you know, it's just amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, the port of Seattle was shut down.
Yeah.
I think most of the coast was shut down.
I just read in the news yesterday that the FBI, so it seems like the Seattle PD, which has its own separate problems with a history of police violence and on-the-street executions lately, has been farming out some of its repressive work to the FBI. So the FBI in the last 2 weeks has raided a number of homes of supposed Occupy activists. What's funny is that the warrants say that the justification for the warrant is they're looking for anarchist material, anarchist literature, right? So I would just point out that anarchism is not illegal. It is not a crime. And using a warrant to search for anarchist literature is a little terrifying to me.
I also wanted to just share, I was there for a discussion on racism, and it was an incredibly beautiful discussion.
Was it?
At the General Assembly. You know, it was so calm, so compassionate, so everybody really there. And the people of color were explaining, or asked, and asked also, why people of color weren't participating. And one of the big reasons was because they know that the police will hit them harder than anyone else. And so there, out of that discussion came a group of allies, the white allies, to make sure they would be there to back up other people. I wasn't there a lot after that to see how that, you know, really worked. Well, actually, I did see one time when it wasn't working. But,
it was
the most beautiful discussion I've
seen. That's awesome. We've got a bunch of people who want to talk, so I'm just going to create a stack here, okay? You were then, and Winifred, and you. Okay, sir.
Okay, so my question, the decision-making process for all of these groups has been kind of American consensus.
Of variable sorts, yes.
Yeah, and in Egypt, it's pretty simple. I mean, you've got a dictator that's, you know, so the answer, it's not that hard to come up with. For a lot of these other austerity programs, the solution is not simple. I mean, there really is no simple, we do this and it's okay.
That's right.
And it just strikes me that that organizational model, I haven't seen it come up with answers to.
Right. So this was a huge debate within the early days of Occupy. So if you recall, Adbusters calls, what is our one demand? Right. Does that, Can you get all of your dissatisfaction into one demand that we can present to lawmakers and have them fix things? That was what they wanted, right? Instead, the early occupiers in Wall Street adopted a slogan very early on that had been part of the student occupation movement 2 years previously in universities around the country, but especially on the West Coast, which was occupy everything, demand nothing, right? And the point there, which is hard to understand if you're focused on creating a concrete solution, right, is that the criticism here is that if you come up with a set of concrete demands that lawmakers can do to pacify you, you are in some way legitimating the very system that is causing the problem. Instead, they're engaging in what is sometimes called prefigurative politics, an attempt to live the world you want to have at the moment you are in. Very much Aikido in a way. It says, you know, we're going to refuse the false binary questions we're being asked, right? Do you want the tax rate to be 31% or 25%, right? That's not a choice. That's not a reasonable choice. Neither one of those tax rates will solve our problems, right? There are no easy fixes, as you correctly point out. The problem is that by asking people to come up with easy fixes, you know, and demanding that of them as if that was the bulwark of, or the measure of responsibility, we end up defeating and pulling the teeth of these movements. Now, at the same time, you're absolutely correct. I haven't seen a concrete proposal. I would like one, but I think, you know, those are the arguments that have sort of been volleyed back and forth about sort of should we come up with concrete proposals.
Isn't that more effective in the long term?
I think so. Yeah. It's more effective in the long run in achieving the goals I want to see, right? It's certainly not effective in creating short-term reform in politics. It really loses ground on that thing. But I know where I stand on this, and that's on the side of the people who are trying to create a whole new system and throw things almost completely over. Yes, sir.
I've been living in Poland for the last 4 years, and I wonder if there's anything to be learned from Solidarność. It's a longer conversation, no time for now, but I'd love to talk with you about some things that I've seen since I've been
there. I would appreciate
what made that whole thing work and the role of Lech Walesa and some other things.
I would appreciate that discussion very much.
I was just going to ask, what effect do you think that 40 suppressive voting laws will have that's right now speaking of
I'm going to say something very provocative here. I'm thrilled with the voting repression movements. I'm thrilled with them. The sooner people, in my opinion, realize that voting is not going to cause social change, the better off we will be. I'm thrilled with it. I think the complete illegitimacy of our representation system as it currently exists needs to be recognized. As Connie pointed out, Scott Walker had to spend millions upon millions of dollars that he got from the Koch brothers, right, in order to win election. He won it. You can buy elections these days, right? You can just go to Walmart and pick one up. And so while I am aggrieved and I am actually involved in anti-voter repression work right now, I do actually work against the voter repression, I'm privately somewhat encouraged by it, simply because I think that it will increase the amount of widespread acknowledgement of the illegitimacy of the system.
It'll be like the pepper spray at Davis.
Yep. I don't think elections are going to work for us right now. And that's not a blanket statement against representational politics in general, but I think that right now we are so broken on that front that I don't know where to go with that.
This is just kind of a general statement. I think that with like all these images and stuff, they are very shocking things that are really happening.
Yeah.
I think it's, but throughout, like it's, it creates such a response in people.
Yeah.
But I think that it's really important in whatever kind of movement somebody's involved in, not to confuse awareness with fear-mongering. Awareness with fear-mongering.
Yep.
If you are making people more aware of things, then whatever your natural response is going to be what motivates them. And I think it's important not to kind of confuse that with something. I mean, I'm from a really conservative area, so I've been aware of Tea Party politics my whole life, because that's what it was.
Right.
So I know that is not something that creates real change. I mean, it can be very effective, but it's not.
I absolutely agree with you.
I think that within like even conversations like this, I think that it's important to address things and recognize them, but also bring up examples like you were saying with like interracial dialogue. Like that's an example of something that's very difficult, but is a way of moving forward.
There are positive things happening and attempts at solution. I think that anytime you try and characterize something as complex as all of these things in a real quick and easy way, which is what I saw the Tea Party doing, right? You have a very effective promotional device, right? And it's great marketing. And as my father always told me, if you ever see anything advertised, you don't need it. Right? So it's great marketing, and it's very effective in scaring people and stirring things up. But it is an absolute refusal of complexity. It's a refusal of what one of my great heroes called maybe logic, which his idea was that the whole world would be better if people just said maybe more often, right? Maybe this would work. Maybe I'm right. Maybe I've got an idea you might like.
But you can't get elected that way.
You can't get elected that way. Again, I'm not such a fan of elections, but
sorry.
Yeah. But it's hard to have complex conversations in situations where binaries are the only form of discussion. Yeah. All right. We do have to come to a close. Is there one more question? Anybody want to make a comment? Yes.
I'm curious what you think.
I'm terrified. I mean, Syria is in full-on civil war. You know, I don't know. I just don't know. And predictions are for saints and fools. Now, Syria is terrifying to me. I know it's spilling over into Lebanon this week. I know that the Alawites, who are a interesting Christian Muslim group, and who are largely representing the who are the ruling elite of Syria, have been Alawite for many years, are now suffering reprisal attacks and pogroms. So, as in with solidarity in Poland, you know, people are together until they aren't. And when they fall apart, and as Solidarity did, it split into many different factions, including some vibrantly anti-Semitic and nationalist Polish movements. And so...
I wish you all could watch TV from Central Europe.
Yeah.
It's a very, very... I mean, it's fascinating to be here now for the last week, and I've just been absorbing all the news and thinking, wow, what planet are we... What planets are we on?
Whenever I've been abroad and I come back, I refer to it as entering the bubble. Because I feel like I'm just entering the doors of a big shopping mall for a while. And after 5 minutes, everything's kind of fuzzy and distant, and nothing makes much sense anymore.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming. And have a lovely lunch.